Welcome to Founders in Biotech. In this podcast, biotech entrepreneurs share their founder's journey and scientific achievements. I'm your host, Sergey Glinka. Today's guest is David Younger. David is a bioengineer and started his biotech journey directly after his PhD. The scientific research was focused on the application of synthetic biology techniques for high-throughput screening of protein-protein interactions. In 2017, David co-founded A-Alpha Bio as a spin-out from the University of Washington. Thank you so much, David, for joining us today on Founders in Biotech.
Thank you, Sergey. I'm very happy to be here.
We start all our episodes with learning more about you. What inspired you to become a scientist? What was your experience with education when you were younger?
Yeah, so I grew up in a medical family. So my dad was a doctor, my mom was a nurse, and started from kind of that early inspiration of dinner table conversations, which tended to focus on individual patient cases or the general healthcare system in the United States. And both my brother and I were pretty inspired by that. So he went off to do an MD PhD. I went off and studied bioengineering as an undergrad, and then went on for my PhD in bioengineering.
So why bioengineering? I mean, you talk about like medical, patient diseases, what is wrong with the healthcare system, but why bioengineering? Why not becoming a doctor?
I think part of it was that, you know, I loved math, I loved science, and I thought that bioengineering was a great way to bridge those interests. Mm-hmm. Another part of it has to do with just scale of impact, right? So as a doctor, you can have impact on a patient by patient case, you know, working at the bedside, and that's incredibly rewarding. I think that as a scientist, as an engineer, there's the potential to develop technologies that can scale far further than bedside care, and that also I found to be very exciting.
So it's kind of, instead of being like face to face with the patient, the idea that you can develop something that will scale this interaction with the patients through some kind of technology or a process.
That's exactly right. Yes.
Okay. And so was it idea already in the early days, like during the table conversations that you had, I like this, but actually I want to do something different?
I don't know if it was ever so explicit. I think I knew that I wanted to work on something that related to healthcare, and went to Rice University in Houston as an undergrad, and you know, was just sort of blown away by my courses in the bioengineering department. And I think in particular, got my first exposure to synthetic biology and this idea of reprogramming cells at a DNA level to get them to do new useful things. And I think for me, I mean, that was just incredibly eye-opening, right? We can not only, you know, scale our impact on patients by, you know, developing technology that's scalable, but we can use biology to do that, right? We can use engineered cells to either develop the therapies themselves or to generate data that drives the development of those therapies. So I think this idea of developing technologies and working in systems that are truly scalable has always been something that's interested me greatly.
Yeah, so it's kind of this more engineered approach to biology, right? Okay. So, and in terms of your company, you co-founded with Randolph, right? How did you meet him? What was the process of meeting and thinking about maybe a first experiments and then a company?
Yeah. So after my undergrad at Rice, I came to the University of Washington and worked with David Baker and Eric Clavins. And I met Randolph during grad school. He wasn't in either of those labs, but was in Georg Seelig's lab in a space that was essentially shared with the Clavins lab. So got to know him peripherally just by working in close proximity. And from his early days in grad school, he expressed interest in entrepreneurship, and he came from Illumina before starting grad school, and had always kind of toyed with the idea of starting a company. And so later on, you know, when I was in my fourth-ish year of my PhD, started having conversations about spinning the technology that I was developing out into a company, and you know, he was a natural person to start chatting with. I think one of the fantastic lessons that I learned from that experience was the importance of making sure that you're working with the right co-founder. Mm-hmm. Co-founders are, you know, just about the most important people in the story of your startup. And both Randolph and I went into those early days with what I think in retrospect was sort of a surprisingly mature attitude of, you know, we need to have a try before you buy, period. So, you know, when we started working together and started about, you know, thinking about laying the foundation for what is now Alpha Bio, we entered university business plan competitions and used that as essentially a crash course of, okay, well, you know, let's learn some of the business stuff. But let's also see how those, you know, really intensive few month crash course experiences, how those stress our relationship and really test how we work together. And we came out of those, you know, just wanting to work together more, which was, you know, the thing that we were hoping for. And that's led to a wonderful now, you know, over 4 years of working together.
Yeah, that's so cool. So I'm jumping ahead, but what makes a right founder? So there's probably not a perfect answer. So the quality XYZ, it's rather what was the right fit for both of you, where you said, okay, this is complementary, or is it even expressible in words what happened actually?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain qualities of founders that are always important, right? It's not about complementing each other, but you know, it's really important that both of us had sort of the grit and the tenacity to feel comfortable getting through challenges, getting through setbacks, right? Yeah. We weren't gonna let the first headwind blow us over. Super important to have really strong communication skills and be able to really challenge each other with feedback and work towards making each other stronger as scientists, as founders. But then I think that there are also aspects where it's been really valuable that we have complemented each other. And I think the example that Randolph and I always turn to is that I'm a perfectionist and have definitely, you know, spent far too long writing a single email, right? And Randolph isn't. He's a drafter, and that's a perfect combination, right? Yeah. Where we've found how to really make processes more efficient and end up with a better result by, you know, kind of having him take tasks that need to, you know, be done quickly, mm-hmm. need to be done efficiently. And then I can kind of, you know, go through with final polishes and I mean, that's worked very, very well.
It makes a lot of sense. So it's not only about the, what is your complementarity, it's just a common shared vision, being able to punch through, to work hard together towards the vision, and being positive and optimistic, and then some kind of complementarity that makes sense. And that's cool. So let's continue with the tech. So you started to work with, so I'm not a bioengineer, and like I need to tell the story how we connected actually. I was working with a IGM group from Marburg, and like supporting them towards the competition. And after they won the competition, that was cool. I kind of gathered the crowd and I wanted to present them some kind of tech from ZoomBio that is not basic research. So often I meet scientists that say, oh, this is basic research. And from like, if you know the problems, you can actually say, okay, you can solve a real problem in the industry. So I was looking and I stumbled upon the paper. I don't know how. And I instantly realized it has some potential. It has actually significant potential to screen for hard to detect interactions between proteins. So let's start how, so you enter the PhD, how is this working out? And then the transition towards like spinning out, how did you learn? Is this just a nice tech or is this tech actually solving problems?
Yeah. So I think, you know, kind of coming back to my interests with science and engineering and starting the PhD, you know, I was certainly thinking about translational technologies, and so wanted to make sure that I was working on something that had translational potential. When I came to the University of Washington, I started working with David Baker, who leads the Institute for Protein Design, and is, you know, sort of the world expert in all things computational protein design, which was a really, really inspiring place to work. And then complemented that with my co-advisor, Eric Clavens, who's a traditional synthetic biologist, really leveraging yeast synthetic biology. And so my thesis work began with, you know, how can we tackle some of the biggest problems in computational protein design using synthetic biology? And I think because that was the approach from day one of entering my grad school work, it meant that, you know, even from that time, we were kind of thinking about this a little bit like a company. And I had you know, no sense of that at the time, but really it was about, you know, let's figure out what the problems are for computational protein designers and make sure that we're developing a technology, that we're developing an assay that generates the type of data that's going to be most useful for solving those problems. And so what I heard from folks in the Institute for Protein Design is that while postdocs and graduate students and undergraduate researchers can design on a computer hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands or millions of proteins in a month, there's an enormous bottleneck when it comes to experimental characterization. And a lot of the focus of that space is on designing proteins that bind with some level of specificity and or cross-reactivity to another set of proteins. And those are experimental results that are typically pretty low throughput. And that has been, again, a major bottleneck for testing designs that are coming out of in silico work.
Okay.
And so, you know, we wanted to build a platform that would solve that problem.
Okay, so let's go through some tough questions, like dive into science. Like what are the challenges in detecting protein-protein interactions? One question. The second, detecting. So this is one game. The other game, what are the challenges in detecting protein-protein interactions on scale?
Yeah, so when looking at kind of the conventional tools for measuring interactions between proteins, I mean, you're looking at technologies like bio-layer interferometry, BLI, surface plasmon resonance, SPR, quantitative ELISAs, all of these technologies that give you quantitative outputs for the interaction strength between proteins require that you purify every protein and measure each protein interaction one at a time.
Yep.
And when you're talking about measuring interactions on the scale of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions, it's just not feasible, right? Which is why, I mean, when you look at the largest public repository of protein interaction measurements, which is BioGrid, which is like the PDB for protein interaction measurements. It pulls from all academic literature. The number of protein interactions that are logged in BioGrid is you know, a little upwards of 1 million. And you know, that's not nothing, but it's pretty darn puny when you think about the vast number of proteins and the number of proteins that interact with each other. I mean, we're talking about an overall network space that's many, many, many times, many orders of magnitude larger than that space. when we start to think about technologies that do scale, I think that there are a couple of challenges. So, you know, now I'm thinking about technologies like yeast surface display mm-hmm. or phage display, mm-hmm. where you express proteins on the surface of either phage or yeast, and you label with some target that you're trying to identify binders against, and you enrich for binders, and then you sequence those binders to differentiate between populations that bind above some threshold and non-binders. And this is kind of, you know, pre-R technology, the state of the art for high throughput yep. measurements of protein interactions. And the challenges with these approaches are really twofold. So one is that they're not quantitative, right? So you're getting information about the strongest binders in that pool, but you're really only learning that they're stronger than some threshold. You're not getting any additional information. And then secondly, they're one dimensional. So you're finding binders against a single target. Sure, you can enrich against a couple of targets at a time, but then you don't know which ones each of those proteins are binding to. So for the most part, I mean that you're finding binders against a single target. And when we start to think about much more complex problems that are, you know, really front and center across the pharmaceutical industry, we're thinking, you know, how do we find protein binders? How do we find antibodies, for example, that are highly cross-reactive? So, you know, bringing this to the real life case of the coronavirus pandemic, right? So how do we find antibodies that are not just going to bind to a single isolated strain of SARS-CoV-2? How do we find binders that are going to be cross-reactive across many strains? How do we figure out which are the right antibodies for this particular strain? And how do we potentially predict what are going to be the binders that are suitable against new emerging strains even before they emerge? There's no way that we can generate that type of data or train those types of models with one-dimensional data sets where we only have binding against a single protein variant.
Yeah. Oh, so we have different technologies that can detect protein-protein interactions. We need protein supply to do that. That's also kind of a huge bottleneck. And then we have technologies like surf display technologies that, as you said, one-dimensional and don't detect or are able to detect only the strongest binder. I like what you said. Like sometimes you want to have cross-reactivity, at least some data about that. So how AlphaSec is overcoming these problems and opening new doors?
Yeah, so with AlphaSeq, what we've done is essentially repurposed a native yeast mating pathway. So the way that the assay works at a high level is we have two populations of yeast cells, and we build two separate libraries. So for example, we can build a library of antibodies in one of those sets of yeast cells and a library of antigens in the other set of yeast cells. And then we've engineered the system such that when we mix those two libraries, we're essentially sampling protein interactions by cells that are colliding, figuring out whether or not, once they collide, they stick to each other. So it's an agglutination-based assay. In this case, we're repurposing yeast mating. So once the cells collide with each other and stick, they've been engineered to fuse and combine their genetic information into a single cellular compartment. And then we can use a next-gen sequencing readout to determine the number of cell fusions that occur from every possible pairwise interaction and use that to get a quantitative measurement of each of those interaction strengths. So for example, if we have 1,000 different antibodies and 1,000 different antigens, we build those two yeast libraries, we throw them in a liquid culture, we kind of do all of our AlphaSeq processing, we run a single NGS run, and then we can now measure all of those million possible pairwise interactions between those two libraries.
Yeah. Once again, I really love this paper, the approach, because it's different. It's different. And there's one detail I still don't understand is the quantification part. How do you measure So I remember it's picomolar to micro millimolar. So how could you close the gap, the knowledge gap for me?
Yep. Not millimolar, okay. Not at millimolar yet, but we can go into double digit micromolar. So still pretty darn weak interactions. So essentially what we're looking at is the frequency of cell fusions. So if we have a really strong interaction between an antibody and an antigen, say it's a 100 picomolar interaction, and we express those proteins on the surface of our yeast cells and we incubate them in a liquid culture, they will fuse, they will bind together and fuse with a certain frequency. And if we have a weaker interaction, say a micromolar interaction, we express those proteins on the surface of yeast cells, those will also fuse at some frequency, but it'll be considerably less. And so if we do both of those in the same pot, then from next-gen sequencing, essentially what we're getting are counts for the number of cell fusions that we observe from each of the possible pairwise interactions. And so a higher number of cell fusions indicates that that interaction must have been stronger to drive a higher frequency of cell fusion. And we're looking at this again, you know, at a massive scale. So we're you know, way over sequencing so that we can see not just what cell fusions are taking place, but each of the relative frequencies of each of those cell fusions. Because AlphaSeq is a highly multiplexed assay, we can also essentially reserve a small percentage of that assay for positive control interactions. So in every AlphaSeq assay, we can include an interaction that we have, you know, previously measured, benchmarked with bioleinterferometry or surface plasmon resonance that we've previously benchmarked as a, you know, 100 picomolar interaction and a nanomolar and a 10 nanomolar and a 100 nanomolar. And so when we do our analysis, we can essentially trace a standard curve using those known control interactions and then compare all of our other experimental data to get not just sort of relative interaction strengths, but to actually put this in an absolute affinity scale.
Great. Now I get the idea. It reminds me of SDS page where you have a marker and you have your and you kind of can relate to that. Okay.
Yep. Or a DNA gel exactly. with a ladder, right? It's just including some sort of a control that, you know, we know, we use it in every assay that we perform, and we can compare all of our unknowns against.
Great, thanks for the deep dive. It was super valuable. So let's go back to the founder journey. Like you are still a scientist, but you were like first like doing only science. What core skills? I'm always curious about, like, you come from the bioengineer. Are there any skills from bioengineering that help you to master entrepreneurship? And on the other side, what skills did you have to learn from scratch?
Yeah, so I think that there are definitely skills that are very translatable. So one of them, I don't know if it's a skill, but it is this grit, right? I think that, you know, as a PhD student, you know, you become accustomed to failure. You become accustomed to experiments failing and projects not working and frustration. You stick with it and you come back each day and you put a smile on your face. And the same can certainly be true psychologically in starting a company. So you know, you deal with rejection, you deal with setbacks, and you need to kind of just let those go and move on and keep building what you're building. Learn from those mistakes, but keep building what you're building. I think that the other maybe, you know, more tangible skill from not just bioengineering, but really any science or engineering discipline is learning how to ask the right questions and learning how to use your resources to their fullest to solve those questions, right? Creating hypotheses, going out and testing those hypotheses. And I think that this really clarified for me when, you know, in the very early days, thinking about thinking about customer discovery, right? And you know, for us, we're building a pipeline internally at AlphaBio. So we're developing our own therapeutics. But the way that we've gotten started and still a major part of our work is partnering with pharma companies. And so it's super important that we're building something that is perceived as being useful by those partners. And so, you know, in the early days, we had certain ideas for, okay, you know, we think that this is going to be the best application space for this assay before we sink a ton of time and resources and energy into building that thing. Let's go out and talk to people in the pharmaceutical industry and really, really make sure that that's the right place to apply the platform. And the way that you do that is, right, you create hypotheses about the market, about what people are willing to pay, about timelines, you know, kind of all of those other assumptions that you have. You generate hypotheses, and then you go out and you test them, right? So using the scientific method, using that training from undergrad and graduate school has been really, really valuable in that way.
Yeah, great to hear it from you that you create a hypothesis. You don't have to have the perfect product yet, but you know that you can do particular experiments. You have a certain confidence, but in order to prove that, it will take too much time, too many resources, and maybe miss the demand, right? Miss the problem. So you're talking about the platform. What was the process in the beginning? So you have some kind of tech. You're deciding we're going to go to become a platform, or we're going to like develop assets, which is a different approach, right? Develop assets from the beginning, or like test the platform, build it, and then see what happens.
It is certainly a different approach. And what we have found is that there are opportunities to leverage both as long as you really think through that, right? I mean, I think that the challenge that a lot of companies experience is that you get put in a box of one or the other, and it's difficult to break out of. And additionally, if you're splitting your resources across both, that can also create a lot of focus challenges. For us, we've used partnerships to essentially try to make all of our other work more efficient, right? We're working with industry experts who bring all of the experience, all of the expertise, all of the know-how, all of the technologies that are outside of our core competency, which began as, you know, this single yeast assay. We really leverage partnerships to help us validate that technology by providing the inputs and then taking those outputs and moving them on to functional assays. And so, you know, in our early days, those partnerships were essential in demonstrating the utility of the assay and even giving us the confidence that we wanted to use the assay for our own internal work, right? We essentially proved it using those partnerships and then we're able to pull it internally and are now doing some of both. So we're still kind of working on some really cutting edge, very exciting applications with partners, working outside of, you know, kind of our main therapeutic area of interest, outside of our reserved targets of interest, to keep pushing the boundaries of the platform, generate some revenue, prove ourselves as a team, while continuing to make progress on our internal pipeline. I think another thought that I'll share here is, you know, my co-founder and I, Randolph and I are both first-time founders, and so I think that another benefit of partnerships in the early stage was building that credibility, right? Being able to prove that we have something that's valuable to the market, being able to prove that we can execute, having folks that our VCs can pick up the phone and call and say, you know, what's it like working with these guys, right? They're totally new. They've never done anything like this before. You know, building that track record through partnerships was far more important potentially for us than it might be for a serial entrepreneur that you know, has already has already proven that they can do it. For them, it might make a lot more sense just to jump straight into an internal therapeutic program.
Yeah. I love it what you're saying, because for me, I'm like also first-time founder, and like you described just the biotech model, like service and potentially generating some assets and partnering. I think humbleness is the key, especially when you're playing science, right? And approaching partners and clients with humbleness and doing the best you can, the best job you can to build this credibility. So yeah, let's do kind of a rapid fire questions. What was your, about entrepreneurship, what was your greatest failure?
You know, I think I've been fortunate to not have had what feel like in retrospect as huge failures. I think coming back to that customer discovery conversation, there were a couple of kind of early business models, early applications of the platform that we were sure, you know, this was going to be it. And then we went out and we talked with the industry leader in that space. And they said, oh no, you know, we don't care about that at all.
Yeah.
At the time, those felt like big failures and big setbacks. But in retrospect, you know, I think that was all part of the essential journey for getting to where we are.
What would be your number one advice for a scientist and founder to keep in mind?
The team is everything, right? Your team is by far your most valuable asset, the most valuable resource in building a company. I think that particularly as a technical founder, a technical CEO in the early days, and I think I'm still probably somewhat guilty of this, of you know, trying to be involved in the science, because you know I love that aspect of our company. I'm fascinated by our science. You need to step away, and you need to bring people into the team who are smarter than you, who are better than you at each of those individual pieces of building the business, including the science. And so I'm super fortunate to have Randolph as co-founder and CTO. I'm super fortunate to have, you know, all of our other incredible members of the team. But I think that, you know, giving up that ownership of the science is challenging, but it's something that needs to come sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Otherwise, you will probably dilute your impact, right, within the team.
You'll dilute your impact, and you'll not take full advantage of the talents Absolutely. Of the team. Right. You'll kind of have your voice dominate those conversations where really, I mean, right, you want people in each of those roles, right? In a data science role, in a technical operations and engineering role, in a, you know, in an R&D role. Like you want those people to be better than you would then you would be able to carry out.
Absolutely. I think over the course of growth, there, like you begin to solve more and more problems or generate data, and you kind of can tackle more problems, becoming more complex. So you have to have people kind of fully committed to particular areas, right? So it's not just, we're still doing the same. It's changing.
Yep. And I think that as a scientist, as an engineer, and a founder, I think that can be a difficult process to go through.
Okay, so you begin not to understand everything, right? So you need to abstract quickly, or at least get the information so you can, okay, I get it, right? Okay. In terms of market, what are the next sectors where you see growth in biotech in future?
So our two areas of focus, which I think are very exciting market opportunities, are molecular glues in the field of targeted protein degradation and biologics, and really pushing biologics towards in silico design, right? Using machine learning to be able to predict novel binders that will bind to a particular specified target. And I think both of these areas are incredibly exciting for different reasons, right? So in the targeted protein degradation space and the molecular glue space, I mean, these are opportunities to develop a completely new modality of therapeutic that allow us to go after targets that have never been druggable before. And so the potential to tackle diseases that have, you know, stymied the scientific and medical community for decades is possible, right? So that's just incredibly exciting. And in the biologic space, the pace at which we will be able to develop protein-based therapies is already accelerating. It will continue to accelerate, you know, in this sort of flywheel effect as we generate more data, as we build more sophisticated, more predictive models. And that means that, you know, the next vaccines, the next therapies for oncology, but also for, you know, new emerging infectious diseases, right? Will that timeline will shrink, and that will mean, you know, better outcomes for more patients. So I think both very exciting spaces, and both, right, that are dependent 100% on protein-protein interactions. So you know, we're really excited to be able to have a significant impact across both of those spaces.
Great. One last question. Do you have a wish for future of entrepreneurship in biotech?
One trend that I've seen and I hope continues is more technical co-founder CEOs. I think that, you know, there is kind of, you know, the resounding challenge of imposter syndrome in many industries and in many roles. And I think that, you know, this is one where if you didn't feel some degree of imposter syndrome, you know, you'd be a bit crazy, right? So, you know, as a technical founder in a CEO role, never having had that experience previously, you have a ton to learn on day one. You know, you're not prepared for your job, but that's okay, right? Because you can learn those things. You can surround yourself with the best and the brightest. You can have the right network of advisors and mentors. And I think, you know, frequently it really is the technical founder, the inventor who has the right vision and who would be the most successful in the CEO seat, but who feels as though they don't have the business chops. And so they pass it off to someone else who doesn't have that right vision and who can't be as successful in that role. And I think that, you know, we've certainly seen in tech, you know, many examples of technical CEOs that have you know been wildly successful, and I think we're starting to see more and more of that in biotech, which is something that I find very exciting.
Thanks, David. What's the best way to reach out to you?
Best way to reach out to me is probably on LinkedIn. Shoot me a message. Very, very happy to connect with new folks in the industry and new folks who are considering starting companies or who are in their early days of starting companies.
Thank you, David, so much for joining us today on Founders in Biotech.
Thank you, Sergey. Yeah, a lot of fun talking with you.
Thanks for being with us on Founders in Biotech podcast. We'd like to thank CSL Behring for supporting this initiative. If you want to raise awareness on cutting-edge science, emerging technologies, and innovation, please do reach out to us and visit foundersinbiotech.com. See you in the next episode.